Let me report. Kathleen says that the themes that she's interested in are very similar to the interests of Nate and Emmanuel. So she, I don't know if she's been in, has
no,
she?
No.
But she said she.
It makes sense.
So I think we'll assume that she'll just join that group and then, so. And we already have a thing on the research group site with your names there, so I'll add Kathleen. Okay. So, what Stephen says is, in his email, in terms of projects, I'm leaning towards working on the trucking project for my paper. I wasn't getting the sense that there was a lot of interest in the union cab idea. There is a group committed to it. Maybe I could find a way to contribute. If not, I've been working on some exciting stuff with regards to trucking that would address the issue of sustainability, safety, working conditions, and ownership. So, and that's his postdoctoral fellowship was on that. And I think it's perfectly fine, you know, in his case especially, to do a project that isn't part of a team. But if there was going to be a transportation-based group of some sort, then he could certainly be part of it. So is his diagnosis right, that there wasn't anybody who wanted to follow up on possibly a union cab project? Which is fine. So I'll just, I'll have Stephen for the moment as a group of one on trucking. Ann Reynolds is interested in governance and worker-owned cooperatives, and can either, you know, can do that in conjunction with other people, or that's really what her work is on. So was there is there an emerging cooperatives node? So not at this point, okay.
Wasn't
Trevor's?
Yeah, it's just that's what
I'm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Isthmus Engineering project.
Yeah, so.
Okay.
It would. So that's good. So Ann and Trevor on cooperatives, and she can then focus on. I mean, you guys can figure out how you want to work it. Okay. Okay, so now where does everyone else stand? Let's see. We'll just go around, and I'll be the secretary and take notes. And it's okay if things aren't fully consolidated yet. I just think we want to keep, you know, track of where things are.
I think Tyler and I are off and running on healthcare. The piece that's on that website right now is something that I wrote before he and I linked up, and we're a little more focused now in terms of topic than what's represented on the website.
Yeah, so just keep sending me memos, and I'll keep posting them, and people can look at them. And
okay.
And if you ever want me to delete something that's on there, I can do that too. You know, this doesn't have to be an archive.
Okay.
It's a kind of working site. I don't know. I'm not on top of the software to wikiize this. But it's at the moment, this is just a web page that I manage and people send me stuff. I would be happy to set up the class in a more wiki interactive format for this, which I know is not that hard to do if you know how to do it. So if there's anybody here who does know how to do it, we can just sit down and set up a more interactive site.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've done that before. So I could help.
Okay, so we can later. Okay, so that's the healthcare. Okay, Nina, where are you in terms of?
I'm taking this other graduate course in environmental sociology where I have to write a paper as well. So I was just beginning to wonder if some kind I could make a research I could use for both. And if I can that, I would maybe like to join your group. But I haven't really talked to Jill Harrison, that's my professor there yet.
Professors are never almost never do they object to having a student work on a project that serves for two classes because you actually get better work done that way.
Yeah, that was what I thought, so instead of like trying to do those two big papers in November and both will be...
Yeah, I think that's... that's that, and it may be that you'll, that there would be some piece of it that you might do that would be just directed towards the other.
Yeah, I thought that might be like two different perspectives, but
yeah,
I could maybe
sure.
use some of the time.
Okay, so
I just check or talk to her and then, or do you just think it's all right, or?
It's always good to check with her, but you can tell that it's fine with me, that you're doing it as a group project here, so, you know, there'll be spillovers and whatever, it's fine, from my point of view, just discuss with her. To give your group, so the focus of, as your thing is evolving, is environment and food, or more food, or what? What? How are you thinking about the parameters?
I mean, there's different strands. There's one education strand, you know, because the whole project centers on the school.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there's some kind of organizational political strand as well, because they're just emerging, and there's like three different, like, or a couple of different big partners involved in the same project. So, you know, there's like issues between the different partners and how they want to structure the whole project. Then there's definitely also some kind of like financing issue, because, you know, they, again, they're still emerging pretty much. So the question where they're going to get their money from, what they're going to do with it.
I guess sort of institutional design and whether that's being created in a way that's consciously aimed towards environmental or community objectives, social objectives, and if so, how are they thinking about that, or what they're trying to do?
Like, I guess the environmental aspect comes in through like the gardens they're planting or haven't planted yet. I mean, there's literally just one little small field, and comes in through like the growing power kind of like connection, which is one of the partners in there.
Okay, good. So, in terms of just giving it a it'll be the Resilience Center project.
Sure.
That's what we'll call it. Yeah, each group should give me a working title. Stevens is the trucking project. Keep on trucking. Trevor is Isthmus Engineering.
Or high tech.
High tech cooperatives, yeah.
High tech cooperatives
and then Isthmus Engineering. And I think Anne actually has very good connections with them, so you'll have full access to. Okay, Juhi, how's your...
I'm thinking between two options. One is, before this class, I thought that I met Catherine here today. I mean, meet Catherine here and talking about a project, but, I mean, that was the one option, and the other option was, I was interested in this group.
Well, Kathleen is part of that group, so
now you're there.
I mean, I don't see any, you know, I don't see any problem in it becoming a, you know, a bigger group. That just means you have, it's a challenge if you have five or six people in a research focus. It's a challenge because you have to figure out real tasks and different focuses, but it really means you can develop this agenda that you lay, you know, you call them strands. That's a good way of framing it. And then people will focus on different ones, and then you'll figure out how to integrate it. So it's completely fine with me. I don't mind there being an imbalance that some groups are two, some are five. That would be fine. So I'll put you for the moment, and then, of course, everything is changing. So Emmanuel and Nate have spoken. Unhi, where are you on your thinking?
I'm thinking... Actually, I'm a student in social work and social welfare, so I want to do something related to more low-income people or low-income community. So I want to see how this social economy have an impact on these folks or community. I don't mind any sector or any field.
Okay. So let's keep going around and then we'll see where we stand. And Thailand, you're on the health project. Is that being defined as these community centers? Is that the...
Yeah, we had one meeting last week and we are supposed to schedule one for this one, but it's going to be around the federal...
okay, so... Federal, what is it officially called?
Federally Qualified Health Centers.
Federally
FQHC is the acronym.
Health Centers, okay. Aicha.
I'm interested in Trevor's project, basically. It's with engineering.
Okay.
And issues of competitiveness.
Okay.
And governance.
Okay, so have you guys talked?
Yeah.
Some?
Michael, Aicha, and I.
Yeah.
So that was, yes. So that's a four person.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And Joao?
Okay, my first idea was I really want to do work with Native Americans in the United States,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not sure I can actually do a long paper by myself. It's actually very complex. And I was reading about it and how those Native American communities were organized in the United States in the first place, which is a body of literature that I'm not aware of.
Mm-hmm.
It would entail a lot of work, so I'm thinking maybe of changing my thing. And my main interest would be the question that I was thinking on that empirical work was to look at the role of the community in building social economy initiatives. So now that I'm thinking about changing, I could join any group. That's a very...
So when his interest is in low-income communities and I assume things like the problems of what in some of the readings today called insertion, that is how social economy activities can be a way of drawing relatively marginalized groups into the more mainstream of community and economy. Would that be a possible focus? So I mean, I don't mean to be...
probably the organization has some purpose or goal to make people push back to the mainstream economy, but
to push back, but well, okay, I'm to make them less marginal to the society,
yeah.
And to economic life, even if it's not mainstreaming,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't.
Probably they could create their own economic unit.
Right.
Or, yeah.
Indeed, that's one of the tensions in this book today. Is some of these things sound like merely bridges back into completely conventional employment, and others constitute alternative in this. And particularly for, I think, around this question of social inclusion, that's a very big and important and difficult theme, whether the way to deal with marginalization is assimilation or construction of new spaces. Yeah. Okay, so I'll put you together as a emergent team.
What is the organization?
Did you? So there will certainly be empirical things even in the area here that one could find for that. There's no rule in this design of these projects that they have to be Madison based. I mean, they, in fact, you live in Milwaukee, so it could be in Milwaukee, certainly.
I'm willing to travel to New York, so if there are any good examples.
You might talk, and I'll facilitate it for you. There are, in COWS downstairs, they have a bunch of Milwaukee projects that are concerned with things like skill formation and the like. So a lot of their things are much more integrationist in the sense of trying to get young black men into the metal trades, for example. But they, I am sure they know about initiatives that have more of a social economy character. to them. And so, yeah. And is everybody, there's nobody not here. I mean, Kathleen's not here, and Anna is not here, but.
Lindsay Quinn.
Oh, Lindsay. Now, she's also interested in cooperatives. She sent a memo to me, which I haven't read. I know that that cooperatives and the relations of production within cooperatives, essentially the question of democratic governance, is something that she's interested in. So it's possible that she could be, you know, part of the high-tech cooperatives group. You know, and that might then be the base, since Anne knows everything about what's going on in the area, that might be then a basis for having more than one site rather than just being a single site. So what I'll do, just so that I have everybody on here, I'll just put in maybe Lindsay. Okay. Now, just to give you some timelines, on October 13th, Matt Hancock is coming. On the 27th, we're having our discussion of the Bankler book, The Wealth of Networks. That's a completely different kind of world. That's basically about intellectual property rights and the formation of cooperative collectives of people around things like open source software. I consider things like that part of the social economy. Most people who write about the social economy don't. You know, I think of it as kind of almost pure social economy, because you're directly producing goods and services for collective use without any market intermediation. So to me, it's a perfect example. But since the language and the preoccupation of the social economy comes out so much from the world of thinking about disadvantage and marginalization, I think these other that kind of project are seen outside of it. The Bankler Week should be great fun. It's a good book, and I think we'll have a lot. The 20th, nothing is scheduled for. What I think would be good, that's 3 weeks from today, I think it would be good to have each group have a real plan. You know, it's what, in a different context, could be called a proposal, but it's not. You know, by the 20th, you should have a statement of the project, of the empirical focus that you want to have, where the sites will be, what are the different kinds of dimensions you're planning on exploring. If it's a big multi-group plan where there will be a division of labor, some indication of how you're thinking about that. And what would be nice would be if those documents could be available by the beginning of the week, and we'll treat those like we treat the interrogations. I mean, we won't have it. The agenda would be just to discuss them, for us all to discuss all of them. But if you can get those to me by our usual Tuesday morning time, the day before, then I will assemble them and circulate them. And that will be our focus for the discussion on the 20th, just going through each proposal. Everyone not involved in the proposal then should be come with questions to ask the people who did the proposal. You know, so the idea will be, it'd be like a proposal hearing, in effect, but your quote, committee is everybody else in the seminar for what you're doing. And I, 2 days may not be enough lead time for me to make a lot of bibliographic suggestions, but I'll do some. And that's another thing that we should all be thinking about, any sources that anyone knows that would be relevant to particular projects that people do. So that's the agenda for the 20th. Therefore, on the 19th, these programmatic sketches of the project, yeah, let's call them project sketches rather than proposals. The programmatic project sketches. I'll send an email to remind everyone.
Should this be one document per group?
Or I think so. I would like a consolidated document. It means you'll have to meet and negotiate it. Yeah, it should be one document. Of course, if depending on how complex you feel you can do by that point, different people in the group can write different chunks of it. It doesn't have to be homogeneous voice or anything, but yeah, a consolidated document. To the extent that you can have something that's even like a sketch of an outline, just of the kind of sections you're thinking about, that's fine, but that's not, doesn't have to be that developed.
And that's an evening class, right?
On the 19th is an evening class, mm-hmm. That's right.
It's on the 20th.
Right, because on the 20th, I mean, because on the 20th, Farber is a Haven Center visitor. Yeah, so that's exactly right. So that'll be an evening class. At this point, I think here rather than meeting elsewhere, but we could meet elsewhere. We could meet at my house or some other place, but let's assume it's here for the moment. Okay.
And so does the banquet will be in
the following week.
Yeah. So it's an afternoon, it's a night class at home.
Yes, I'll be with Bankler's talk is at 4. So Bankler's talk's at 4 to 5:30, and we'll, you know, have some kind of, I mean, not go to my house or anything for dinner, but maybe go down to the Union or something for dinner and then have the seminar here in the evening, on the 27th.
Will Bankler be attending the seminar? Or
Okay. Yeah, I suppose there is the issue about whether we would want to fold our seminar into the Thursday Haven Center seminar, but I think it's probably better for us to have our own event rather than have it be part of that. And I don't think he's not going to object to having an extra thing to do. It's kind of comes with the territory for these things. And then after Bankler's visit, which then means starting November 3rd, we will have weekly sessions. And I think those can be afternoon even when there is a Haven Center thing, because they can be shorter. The purpose of that's to just each week have people come in and give a report, a progress report, rather than just have it drift. But then on some weeks, we'll focus on a particular project. And that's up to you to let me know. So the idea would be you'd communicate to me by Tuesday, ideally with a little memo of some sort, which I would again distribute, and that could be a focus for a brainstorming on some issue that you're having. And that will just evolve as it evolves by how the work goes. Kind of collective advising, as it were. Okay? And we can see how things are going. We could decide to miss a week. If it seems a more efficient use of everybody's time to just be focusing on the work and not having a discussion on a particular week, that's something we can decide as we go. All right. Okay. So, everybody have the agenda for today?
Anybody? I read it online if you have extra.
I have, I have 3 copies, I think. So I tried to group these a little bit more. It struck me this week more than some of the interrogations that people wrote were less posing a question and more just commenting on some aspect of what they were reading. So I had to do a little bit more work to kind of distill what's the agenda item implied by the interrogation. So I hope I've done justice to what people were writing about. The theme that seemed in one way or another to touch on the most of you in one way or another talked about was the question of whether social enterprises as described in this book, what they actually could contribute to transformation. The main thrust of the book is to characterize social enterprises as a solution to a problem, particularly a problem caused by either the weakness of the state, the incompetence of the state, or the withdrawal of the state, or the weakening of the state. You know, various things that are gaps in social provision around various kinds of needs and problems that reflect changes in the way the state relates to these problems. And social enterprises are seen as bottom-up initiatives to deal with this. But a lot of the chapters treat those problem-solving initiatives as mainly just solving the problem or moving towards a solution, and rather than constituting a alternative way of organizing economic activity as a stable goal. And a number of you raised questions that I think are closely connected to that. Emmanuel, Michael, and Juhi all raised different versions, I think, of that kind of problem. So why don't the three of you begin by commenting on that theme and how you're thinking about it. Sure, you could do it in the order that I listed.
But I mean, my question just really echoed what you were just saying, that, hey, like, it seemed that all this, the emergence of all the social enterprises was closely linked to, like, problems or shortages or shortfallings of the state. And they, as you said, like, were just trying to solve kind of like capitalist problems of like welfare provision, particularly of like unemployment. And yeah, just like mainly situated in the welfare kind of arena. So my question really was like, if their kind of source or like reason for existence is to help the state filling the gaps that the state can't fulfill. You know, can these social enterprises really be like transformative agents? Because, I mean, reading through the book, it seemed to me that they were filling out existing and like operating within the gaps and contradictions of capitalism, but that they were never really trying to change the structure within the way kind of situated. So if that's the case, and if they're really just like existing and acting within the gaps and contradictions, I don't really understand how they can ever like really change or transform the structure within which they operate.
So there's a difference between being founded to fill an existing gap on the one hand, and then seeing yourself as only filling that gap in perpetuity on the other hand. I mean, you can be, an organization could be founded, prompted to come into existence because of an identified gap in the state of the market or a combination, but then not see themselves as having exclusively that function indefinitely and become a transformative organization. Some of the, or at least somewhat transformative, the Argentine worker-owned factories, for example, worker-operated factories might be an example of that. They only came into existence because the business closed, but they ended up constituting something decidedly non-capitalistic.
Manuel,
I mean, I agree that they can, like, there's different motivations, and the motivations can change. But it seems that once the motivations changed and they really try to address structural issues, they always kind of repelled by some kind of opposition. So for example, like the Zambian case or the Zimbabwean case, when the NGOs, they really try to kind of confront the state, you know, and thereby really try to change, you know, some kind of state policy, or I guess which you could then define like a structural policies. They were really kind of repelled, you know. I think the Zimbabwean state sort of changed the law and really restrict the kind of like operational capabilities of the NGOs. And then also in the case of Argentina, I mean, yes, they changed their kind of motives and the kind of their self-identity as well, but nevertheless, they were still in this kind of like legal flux and could have been away with it any moment. I mean, I don't know what the situation is now, but like it always seemed to me whenever we were reading about like the Argentinian case that they were really reliant on the state and the local kind of like legislature to like tolerate them, you know, like basically they were dependent on the existing kind of structural environment for survival. So like even if the kind of motivation changes, and even if they decide that they want to carry out some structural change, I mean, the way I've read everything that we've been reading so far, it seems to me that because they are like creatures of like these gaps and contradictions, they've got real like difficulties in kind of attacking like the structure, even if they decide to do so. But like ultimately, like they don't seem to be like real alternatives.
Sure.
Okay. First, can I, before I make my comment, ask him something?
Yeah.
I'm not sure what you mean by structural transformation.
I mean the kind of socio-political context. Like, I mean, for example, like existing law. You know, the kind of legal base in which they, the legal basis in which they are formed, but then also the kind of, I would say, kind of economic logic to a certain degree. No, I mean that's a gray area.
Okay. So.
Yeah.
So, I think it might be misleading to think that just because the state has retreated, you have a mechanism that leads organizations to feel naturally that vacuum that was created. There are some mechanisms, and the mechanism, I think, more than seeing it as the retreat, you can imagine social groups looking at the retreat of the state as an opportunity for some kind of action. So think about the example of the Italian case of the psychiatric hospitals. So when the state decides to disinstitutionalize the hospitals, you have a psychiatrist that looks at that as an opportunity for generating a new way of understanding psychiatric treatments. And that changes the way, I don't know if it connects what you mean by structural transformation, but it changed the way a population that was formerly stigmatized gets to be included or part of community at large. So there is a transformative action.
I agree, but I guess my concern is more not so much on the kind of emerging side of these institutions, but on kind of on the other side of the dynamic development. So not on the ability of the social enterprise or the social economy organization to spring to life, but on that kind of organization to have a knock-on effect to like the wider legal, economic, and political environment. And I mean, if you say that they have, you know, but simply by the fact of their existence, they're already changing things, right? But I guess the question is whether A, they can do so even if the state, for example, would decide to come back into the space for whatever reasons. I mean, this is really hypothetical and theoretical, but let's say they had suddenly lots of money, the state would decide, okay, we want like to occupy the space again. Then, you know, there might not be any reason for their existence anymore. So, and then B, on the other hand, is like to kind of like more sustainably change this kind of environment, because it seems very fragile to me, the space they're occupying. You know, because the causation runs from the state or from like the shortages and the shortcomings of the state to the social economy, not the other way around, it seems to me.
Trevor and then Tyler and then I'll say something.
I mean, I was just going to say, following what Joao said, I mean, it doesn't seem to me to be inherent that because there is a retreat of the state necessarily what replaces that is not transformative or is not temporary. It seems like there could be sort of an act of agency, an organization which fills that gap. But I see as whether or not it's transformative more depends on the type of organization that fills that gap. So if we're talking about a microcredit program that is going to, you know, so there's been a decline in employment, the state decides to withdraw from supporting the economy, and so there's this increase in unemployment, and so the response is to come in with microcredit programs. That's one type of response, and then a different type of response might be for workers to form a cooperative. In terms of whether or not that type of response increases or decreases the possibility for structural change or change in state policy, it does seem that the creation of an alternative at least exposes the state to the possibility that that service could be provided through a non-capitalist avenue, and so the state might say, oh, well, actually, like, you know, in a number of the chapters we read this week, the state said, even in the Argentinian case, the state said, well, we can do programs to help groups of workers to learn how to organize cooperatives, or it could be a more advanced. So it does at least expose the idea of an alternative, it seems.
Tyler? I think we should think more about this situation again necessitates the emergence of social enterprises, because filling in the gaps of states and or emerging well the state fails to provide a service or some kind of some other stuff is an emerging as a problem solving institutions or enterprises. I mean, I think in this point they should, I mean, social enterprises, if they're really adamant in terms of their despite their entrepreneurial activity, sharing of the sharing the profit or what they gather collectively, I think they should never drop their advocacy group aspect, or what I said last week, social movement characteristics. For instance, in the book, for instance, the chapter regarding Western Europe actually asks the social enterprises to contract out some service provision from the state. I mean, now here social enterprises emerge not only fill the gaps but also to take over some aspects. I mean, do we see if there's a working and functioning service provision funded by the state, run by the state, if there's no problem, would we prefer that its passage over to social economy, or as it, I mean, this the necessity, I mean, these points are really important, I think, because it emerges when the state or market failures are seen, but here in the chapter on the West Unit, they ask for contracting out. And the same thing I would argue this applies with regards to Eastern Europe, because, I mean, the international aid coming into the Eastern European countries are basically aiming to establish a functioning market economy in these countries, rather, and not necessarily to create a social economy environment.
Just one very quick
question. Yeah.
And also, if it's not only to create a functioning market economy, I mean, from my perspective, even in developed market economies, if the social enterprises really just fill in like the failures of the state, it seems to me that they're really kind of propagating like the continuation of the market system.
Let me make a couple of comments on these things. First of all, I don't think it's a test of whether something is transformative, whether or not it's reversible. So the fact that the state abdicates its responsibilities, new things get created, and then the state decides to come in and smash it and reestablish itself, that shows that there's a defeat. That could show that there's a defeat, but not that the efforts that were in place and underway weren't themselves constituting an alternative. indeed it may be evidence that they were constituting an alternative, that they are destroyed under some, in some sociopolitical contexts. In the case of Argentina, for example, you have a lot of recovered factories. The property rights are ambiguous. It's not clear what's going to happen. If in the end a conservative party wins the elections and decides to reassert the property rights of all the original owners and displaces the workers by force and reestablishes them as capitalist firms, I don't think then in retrospect we can say the workers were simply maintaining the factories and preventing them from deteriorating so that they could be retaken by, you know, so therefore they weren't transformative. Now, that could have been the case. You know, it could be that as a strategy, you know, it's not plausible, but it could be that as a strategy to prevent the physical deterioration of the factory's infrastructure, the employers let the workers take it over and run it themselves until they can regain enough credit and capital to retake the factory. So my first point is the reversal or the vulnerability or the fragility, those are all problems and worthy to think about what makes something fragile or not, what makes them less reversible or not. But none of those bear on the directly on the question, do these constitute transformative processes which may be aborted, as opposed to socially reproductive and reinforcing processes in which the transformations are illusory, right? How do we then just figure this out, given that things can be illusory? There can be all sorts of symbolic window dressing that doesn't mean anything, you know, that, how do you really figure this out? Did you have something on?
Yeah, I want to say something on Argentina.
Okay, so do that and then I'll come back to
it. Which is, I think it's misleading to think of Argentina as just state withdrawal, because the states were being recovered from capitalism, from the market. It was a moment of market failure.
Right.
And that was filling a void created by the market. And when the economy and when the workers organize production again, and then, which might happen when you say, okay, now the companies or the factories are making profit again, the capitalist might phone them back, that might actually lead the state to recognize the situation that what happened, so to force in a learning process, as Trevor was saying, that those factories are better for the general community in the hands of the workers,
right,
instead of leaving them to the state, so there is a learning process.
Let me just add to that too. Let's say the state were to then say, let's hold a contracting process. And we're going to put up bids for who would like to run this factory. And a capitalist comes along, and the workers come along as a collective, and they put forward proposals. So you still have a contracting process in which, in a sense, the cooperatives are competing in that sense. But, I mean, this is in response to this question of does this phenomenon of contracting or social economy organizations essentially sort of competing with the market, with capitalist organizations, suggest that they are less transformative, that they're compromising their kind of social or transformative character? They could be potentially presenting an alternative, which the state, as you were saying, might then recognize.
So one of the things this raises is this tendency to have a category as if it was a unitary actor, the state, as opposed to seeing the state as a complex and contradictory structure of apparatuses in which the character of the institutions can be very heterogeneous, including with respect to this question of whether it's reproducing the dominant structures and institutions of capitalism, end of story, or it's reproducing those and various kinds of alternatives simultaneously in a contradictory mix. So again, in Argentina, in some cases, factories or capitalist enterprises get taken over, the new enterprise organized as a workers' cooperative not only runs it and gets tacit permission to do so by the state, that is, it doesn't enforce the old property rights, but they decide to use significant parts of their surplus for social projects in the adjoining communities and build up social housing in recognition of the support that the surrounding community gave the workers in that factory at the time of the crisis, so that you get a very different relationship between this now worker cooperative enterprise in a neighborhood and the surrounding barrio, where community centers and social housing and other things are being built and partially financed by a self-tax on the profits of the worker cooperative. Now that's happened in some areas. It's underwritten by the local state. That is, the Peronists figure this is a good way of building their base, and you know, the old clientelism then gets diverted into these new projects. Well, it's deeply ambiguous. You know, is this just reproducing Peronism with its patronage networks, or are the fact that now the patronage networks involve patronage of worker cooperatives that are acting in a grassroots social movement way, make it no longer a patronage network? It makes it some other kind of hybrid, a little bit of patronage, a little bit of worker appropriation of state resources. You know, so figuring these things out are what you have to do to really know whether something is constituting a transformation. And at the heart of that, I think, is the kind of real utopias question. You have to think through what are the prefigurative forms, which means you have to have a sense of what's the destination, so to speak, which then can be prefigured by moving towards it. So that Italian case with the psychiatric hospital, which in one sense seems like a completely weird case, I mean, you know, when you think about these things, it seems so peculiar because of the nature of the marginalization of psychiatric patients compared to the groups that we normally talk about, you know, the poor, immigrants. But if you then sort of take a deep breath and say, okay, in a democratic and egalitarian world, how there's going to be mental illness, there's going to be schizophrenics, there's going to be a problem of long-term treatment and integration into the community. You don't want people isolated. What would it be like? What would be the kinds of institutions that would embody democratic egalitarian views? And then you look at that Italian case, and it seems to have a lot of those elements. You know, it's not that it's some, you know, perfect fantasy, but it seems to, compared to the asylum of Goffman or Foucault, or the warehousing asylum, or the halfway houses of just maintenance, this seems like really something that does embody these values. And that's why I would consider that a transformative case. That is, it does seem movement that in the direction of a democratic egalitarian ideal in which new institutions are created, governed by new norms, and in which then, in some sense, power has to be organized to sustain it. And the form of power that's sustaining it is, to a significant extent, social power. It's based in, you know, in the communities where these things are occurring, but backed by the state. You know, the state is implicated in this in terms of funding and providing the support. I mean, I'm giving a longer speech than, you know, I normally do for this. So to answer the question, is it transformative? I don't see any way that you can avoid specifying the normative ideals and the principles by which moving in the right direction can be identified. And if the practices do seem to embody that, then I don't hesitate to say, yes, it's moving in the right direction, it has a transformative dimension, but it may be blocked, it may be partial, it may be contradictory. Rather than having a very strong test, you know, the very strong test is, well, does this pose a revolutionary challenge to the system? No. No matter how democratic and egalitarian the psychiatric reconstructed community and workshops will be, it's not going to threaten capitalism. But it does threaten a model of how you deal with a certain kind of marginalization. So the punchlines move away from a unitary state. You can do that without abandoning the notion that the state is a structured institution for the reproduction of the system of capitalism, that it's not just a kind of random collection of, you know, different apparatuses, but it's not unitary. It has internal contradictions, and sometimes those can be exploited and sometimes not. So sentences that have the word "the state" in them are usually elliptical, or a more complicated sentence. And to think through this question of transformation for particular cases, you want to see what the principles are that are embodied in it. And that's why we, you know, we've often focused on the governance issues, because that seems like an easy case. I mean, not easy to do, but it's a kind of clear case. If the new forms are internally democratic and have much more participatory governance, that certainly is one of the prefigurative things we care about. Okay. Let's see. I think, why don't we, let's move down to the second cluster. Unless, does anybody have any follow-ups on this thing? Yeah, Tyler.
I have a question, actually.
Yeah.
In the Argentinian case and in the Italian psychiatric hospital case, there is definitely a part of social innovation on the part of the, as a response to the historical social context, especially in Argentina. I mean, what would usually working class response to this situation would try to block the machines and whatever they have in the factory and try to exchange that for their non-paid wages from the past few months. I mean, this is very general. But in this case, they try to take over the factory and start running the factory by themselves. There's a definite social innovation here, and playing on the complexities of the state structure. I mean, it's playing on the appeal of the Peronist government in power after the crisis. In terms of looking at these examples, I mean, I'm going to ask a more methodological question. In terms of understanding these existing, we're struggling in terms of coming up links with these existing examples for our future projections about social economy. I mean, these are really particular cases, happened in a very historical times at certain regions, but the reproduction, the external validity of these cases becomes more questionable. Or I'm having a hard time projecting those innovations happened in the past for the future.
I'm not sure I see what the particular problem is. That is, what we're trying to do is extract some principles of analysis from these cases, such as examine whether the practices that are embedded in these new innovations embody prefiguratively an alternative to the existing system. And to the extent they do, one can say they're transformative, but in a contradictory way. So that's a principle. Look at the recovered factories, and some of them, but not all, have a lot of that going on. You know, some of them are really powerful examples, and some are very ambiguous examples. But that's a principle. And so you can apply that principle to something that happens in a non-crisis context, where a group of people get together to form an alternative institution for producing some good or service. And we ask, to what extent does it embody principles which are alternative to capitalism, and does it create processes that help to sustain those principles? So, yeah, Joao.
I think the problem with coming up with those principles is that they are necessarily very ambiguous. So a principle could be decommodification, but then okay, let's see what kind of social practice leads to that. But then, for instance, in the psychiatric case, you're actually commodifying people who are not. So those principles are always based on some idea of a system that you could reproduce with a different kind of production. So it is not only that you are looking at principle, but you are looking or you are referring to an alternative general system of production, which is not just principle, it's a larger alternative, which is something that generates fairness or
right.
equality.
So this is getting to some fairly sort of deep social theory points. When you think about the social system, you can identify particular elements and the configuration of elements, right, as being the criteria for what it means to be different. So a given element in a system gets its meaning from its connection to other elements. So the commodification of labor, for example, we think of as a prototypically capitalist phenomenon. But its capitalist character comes from how it's connected to all the other features of capitalism. The simple looking for a job and getting paid for the work you do, which is a characteristic thing of commodification, would not have the same meaning in a world where people have a basic income, in a world where basic needs are being provided by in-kind services, provided by communities and by the state, and in which the organizations that you seek pay for in exchange for work are themselves worker cooperatives, and they just need some extra help, so you go and work for them and get some pay. Now, that particular element, looking for a job and getting paid for it, means something different depending upon all these other contexts, right? And that, of course, makes it more difficult to diagnose a particular innovation or a particular setting, since the meaning of what's going on does depend upon all these connections.
How would you make the connection between the psychiatric initiative being transformative to the extent that you're thinking about generating a different production system or generating a system in which you have a basic income for everyone, or not just commodifying more people?
Let's describe the details of how the labor process, the organizational relations, and the integration of these people into the broader community of economic activity takes place. So now you've read the chapters. How would you describe the details of that case? I don't expect everybody to have read the Italy chapter carefully, you know. But for those of you who read it, let's get the details, and then let's see if the proper diagnosis of the way in which it was done is that this is a project that's broken down a barrier that previously occurred because of inappropriate stigma, which blocked these people from being just ordinary workers. And by engaging in a kind of cultural project of destigmatization, it hasn't produced anything alternative. There's nothing in capitalism that says psychiatric patients should be stigmatized. That's a cultural phenomenon, not a capitalist phenomenon. And so this would be like anti-discrimination against, on the basis of race or gender. Successful struggles to get rid of those barriers are not anti-capitalist, even though they're good. I mean, we could value them. A world without discrimination is better than a world with it. There's nothing anti-capitalist about getting rid of discrimination against women. It just means that women can be incorporated as on equal terms with men in the labor market. So is that the best way of describing the Italian case? That this is just this is like discrimination against women, and it's just a different problem, so they have different strategies for overcoming the stigmatization of mental patients.
I think so.
I mean, I didn't read that section carefully enough to answer my own question. That's why I'm relying on you guys to answer those, whoever read it carefully enough to.
That's the main argument.
Does somebody have the page number? I'm having trouble refinding.
29.
Thank you.
So, I mean, that would be the test in the recovered factory case, in the best cases of them in Argentina. There's no way you can describe this as simply restoring the ordinary functioning of capitalist firms. There's fundamentally different kinds of relations in production and relations of production and relations to community and relations to the local state that get reconstructed in those cases. They may be fragile, they may not last, but they're not just oiling the wheels of the old system.
Actually, it's more interesting.
What?
It's actually much more interesting because it says the environment of what was built today called the business park no longer bears any resembles to a hospital. The park, small businesses are run as six social cooperatives, and consumers are full partners in the enterprises. Employees are organized into small unions, better known as guilds, and the majority of the partners must be consumers. And he explains how the cooperatives work.
So that's not full commodification. That's insertion into a different set of cooperative practices. We may not have enough detail to really know what it's like. Well, there was a hand over here, I think.
No. No, I was just holding my hand.
holding your head.
In thinking about how to identify that transformative character, I keep thinking about what are the institutions which serve to exclude that particular group, and does this innovation serve to bypass or avoid or subordinate, sort of force those institutions to act in a way that they would not have otherwise. So like in this case right here, it says Basaglia and the consumers Basaglia and the consumers quickly came to believe that finding jobs would be the best way to integrate the consumers into Trieste society. Unfortunately, the citizens of Trieste discriminated against the consumers by denying them employment. So it was the practices, the economic practices of the citizens, which was preventing them. So the solution that they found was to bypass them and to create their own economic environment.
So they created these social cooperatives as an alternative to seeking regular employment. But then the question is, are the cooperatives which they created then a distinctively different kind of association of work? One could imagine that what they could have, here's an alternative. You have somebody who is wealthy and has good values, and they see that these people can't get jobs, so they set up a small business, provide the capital for it, and employ them in a sheltered workshop. So sheltered workshops are a conventional way of dealing with disability. A sheltered workshop needs an infusion of capital. It can be done through charity, somebody just as benevolent, or it can be done by the state. Provides work, people get paid. The pay is subsidized because the level of productivity is typically low. But that's a form of insertion that seems minimally different from a capitalist form. It's a little different because of the way in which it requires continuous infusion of subsidies, but that seems to me a way of dealing with the problem that's trying to do as little transformation as possible. The question is, are these social cooperatives with stakeholder councils and stakeholder boards and participation of the former mental patients in the organization of the activity, does it constitute a more fundamental alternative, even if it was created just because of a failure to get past the stigma of the citizens of the region?
Yeah,
Juhi.
They say the profit, I mean, they might not make many profit, but in case they make a profit, it does not go into the owner who make the farm, right? In the capitalist farm, which is made by a philanthropic businessman, the surplus will go to the capital, I mean the investors. But in this case, they said the profit goes to expand their mission and to create more, like more workplace and the more cooperatives. So it might be one difference. And the other thing is because it's a cooperative, the direction, I mean the decision about their direction and existence will be made by the stakeholders, not the philanthropic businessmen. So I think it make a difference.
So the two criteria you gave, the first is what in a bunch of the readings referred to as the non-distribution principle, mm-hmm. so that they retain profits mm-hmm. or to advance the mission. Mm-hmm. And the second is stakeholder governance, which is a broader idea than just worker governance, because mm-hmm. it includes all the relevant stakeholders for it. Yeah, Matt.
So suppose that for those reasons and for other reasons that we've mentioned here, the answer is yes. It is more than a just noticeable difference from capitalism. It is, in fact, something quite distinct from capitalism. And suppose that we can point to principles that we've enunciated that say it's better than capitalism. It's in the service of some notion of human emancipation. It's closer to prefiguring something positive than capitalism is. Then what? We point to it, we have the case, we have our analysis of it, and it's existing. What then?
So, first of all, we give it a gold star. Mm-hmm. But secondly, then we ask, what are the obstacles to this expanding? What is it that keeps this contained in the niche that it's in? What keeps it from replicating? So if, as long as these things are kept to people with disabilities and handicaps who can't function in an ordinary labor market, even if they have these innovative and more communitarian and collectivist characters, but there are mechanisms in place that block this expanding beyond that, then one would say it is indeed, I would say, an alternative, prefiguring broader visions of a more humane world, but it's not a threat to the existing system under these historical conditions. Just as the recovered factories, even the best of them in Argentina, do not at this moment in history constitute a threat to the system. If they did constitute a real threat to the system, if they were seen as such shining examples, my social science prediction is they would be attacked, and they'd be in a much more defensive position. It's because they're seen as not a big threat that they're allowed to continue. That doesn't undermine the claim that they're transformative. It just says that the balance of power in the hegemonic capitalism is still secure in Argentina. There's a hand here, or...
Yeah, I was going to say that it seemed like a lot of the responses in the authors of the book, or the way they were told to respond about their cases, is then what you do once you have a good example is you set up a legal framework which allows people to invest their time and energy and capital and whatever else in things that, you know, are similar to that, so that you're not afraid. You know, the idea of the legal framework is that you're not afraid that the state is just going to come squash you, because you can have something to point to that says, it's okay for me to be doing this, you told me I could.
I find it quite interesting that these, I think it was 2 weeks ago in one of the books that we read about, again, the recovered factories. If you look at the interviews, the workers say that, you know, we were just trying to secure our jobs. So they were really confining it with, you know, kind of we're really respecting property rights and all that. This was the last resort. We had to do it. So in fact, it's interesting because there are a lot of social movements that really do not have a transformative potential, but that use the language of you know, being a threat to the system. Like, you know, we'll transform capitalism, you know, smash, you know, get rid of the capitalists, get rid of the banks and all that. And the attack on these, at least the case that in Turkey, for example, is just in many other places too. It's very prompt, and the state comes in. Like in many cases, you see the violence on the streets and all that. But it's, in this case, it's they don't frame it in that way, and they might constitute a transformative potential. Yeah. But in fact, they. I mean, that's the interesting thing. I mean, how they understand the process itself. If the workers frame it in the you know, in the ideology of that's in a way that is compatible with the capitalist ideology. Like, you know, we're not trying to transform anything. We're just trying to secure food and all that. So, you know, to what extent, or, you know, if we think of, like, the future, when will, or can we make any predictions about, you know, when would there be a moment where, you know, the workers would be aware of this transformative potential?
But in the Argentinian case, workers did become more transformative over time in these factories. Initially, they were just defending their jobs and trying to get paid for stuff.
Can I mean, this is a little bit related to what you were saying, but can I just ask you then, for your perspective, so not regarding the transformative potential, but let's call it then the revolutionary potential. I know that we should bracket this issue out.
No.
But so you don't, essentially, I mean, from what I can interpret here, is that you don't really see it coming from essentially, like, the kind of spark, or, like, you know, the potential that can really change something fundamentally from the bottom up, really from the social economy. It seems to me that really the change is more, has to come from top down, meaning that it comes through, like, an immense widening of gaps and contradictions. And that these gaps and contradictions are not, like, crucially opened up from the bottom up, but from the top down, specifically, like, through the state. I mean, is this the correct interpretation?
No, here's what I would say. I don't know what the process will be for system-level transformation. I cannot construct a plausible scenario, which I find credible, which has any kind of predictive basis, for either a ruptural change, that is, some decisive break, some cataclysmic moment, you know, where you have a real ruptural change, or even a tipping point change, right? It's easy to paint negative scenarios. You know, as soon as something gets threatening, it gets smashed. That's a kind of good first approximation theory of how the world works. I don't have a response to that. And I think that anybody who thinks they do are fooling themselves. I just don't think we have a capacity to theorize that under existing conditions. What I can argue, however, is whatever historical contingencies emerge in the future, which allows for expanding those spaces, for whatever reasons, whether it's because the state becomes more internally divided and contradictory and allows for more space opening, or because the limits of possibility deteriorate from below and the spaces suddenly are bigger, for whatever reason, the more we build alternatives that are prefigurative and that show that alternative ways are possible and that create viable demonstrations, the better positioned collectively we, in the big we sense, will be to take advantage of those circumstances. I don't imagine that that's sufficient. That is, it's not sufficient to have good demonstration models to take advantage. You also need political vehicles to take advantage. You need parties, you need social movements, you need unions that are capable of seizing the time to expand those limits of possibility when the possibility occurs. But they will be better able to do so if they have these good models too. So, I mean, that's my position. Now, whether the key moments of expanding limits will be top-down or bottom-up, I think it's probably at some, I mean, this is a non-answer answer, some combination of the two. I think creating new legal frameworks when the historical possibilities for those frameworks occur does matter. It's possible, for example, to imagine a circumstance where you could have a new kind of bankruptcy law for capitalist firms. So current bankruptcy laws specify the order of claimants on the assets of the firm, right? You know, that's what bankruptcy law does. It says if you go bankrupt, then the creditors or whatever there's some rank order.
Prioritization.
Right. I think paying the workers is probably fairly high up on the list. That is, people getting paid for back wages for work already done, I think it's pretty high on the list. But there's a list. But you could have a bankruptcy law that says when a firm becomes bankrupt, there's a audit performed about its resurrectability. You know, is this so deteriorated and so defunct that there's really no hope? But if there's some salvageable possibility, then the first claimants are the workers to get infusions of capital from the state on extremely favorable loans grounds to cooperativize it. That could be the first line of response to bankruptcy, rather, and so you could have state-facilitated recovered factories turned into cooperatives being a law that only applies to bankrupt capitalist firms. So there's nothing inconsistent with capitalism about it. I'm just saying. Mm-hmm. That would be expanding the limits of possibility. Now, could that happen? You know, I don't know. But
no, I mean, yeah. I mean, I understand, but it just seems from all the examples we discussed that, like, it is, you know, this kind of the potential of the social economy in itself seems, I mean, as a viable alternative, it might be viable, might not be, but just as a more revolutionary, you know, extending the limits of possibility kind of force, it seems limited, right? I mean, this is what pretty much every case kind of demonstrates. Like, it's always, well, it's very confined, whoever it is, and it never really...
In that case, the revolutionary alternative would be this. The factory takeovers had spread it to the other factories,
yeah,
so
no,
they
exactly.
would never
exactly.
went bankrupt. Right?
No, exactly.
But that didn't happen.
Exactly. Yeah, that's, I mean, that wasn't a question I'm
right, so
saying.
But in order for that to constitute a critique, you have to give a plausible argument for an alternative. So, yes, I agree that if factory takeovers in bankrupt firms spread to factory takeovers in profitable firms, that would have been a revolutionary situation. Can we give a scenario under which that's remotely possible? That is, that you have a lot of perfectly good capitalist firms that are well-functioning and are making profits, and in which factory takeovers go from bankrupt firms to functioning firms. In a sustainable way. Now, maybe you can come up with a scenario. You know, general strikes have been proposed. There's been scenarios for this. I don't see the. Yeah.
Yeah, I think one of the scenarios could be, and that relates to the existence of alternative, is that you could have a more efficient system than the one that is run under capitalism, and then it's a matter of comparison of two existing systems. That's just hypothetical, but
assuming that the efficient always gets elected, or like is allowed to.
But you could also think, for instance, in revolutionary terms, the role of those alternatives in building some kind of one or many political instruments that could overcome political obstacles to change. So imagine that you were a cooperative and you at some point you get an obstacle for, I don't know, spread of your alternative. You're revealing the obstacle, and the obstacle might be just political, especially if you are doing something that is profitable and that is good for the public in general. And just by revealing that, you can actually, you have a reference toward building capacity to overcome that obstacle, which is a political move.
I think we should move to some of the other issues. This is perfectly good. I think also it's four, so we should take a brief break. 10-minute break. Okay. And then let's move further.